Okay, today we're going to talk about exoplanets. Exoplanets. Should be a definition on your list there. They're in alphabetical order. So I got my high-tech with me. Not so high-tech, old stuff. And my little hotspot, so we can watch a couple videos along the way here. And some resources from Reasons and other places on exoplanets. Three books there. The subject in the middle called Astrosphere Habitat Zones, that's Hugh Ross's publication. So he, if you want to look that one up, that's a good one. It's online. And then the other three are books, How to Find a Habitable Planet. That's very liberal, you'd say, the belief that planets are habitable, planets are everywhere. And then more conservative, Rare Earth, and more so Alone in the Universe. So those are three sources. And Reasons has some other resources. They have programs for you. There's the, if you look at that little depiction that came up there, Reasons Institute, a lot of courses, and Reasons Academy for high school level and junior high. There's a help desk, and there's a Reasons Institute for teachers. And there's a one of the courses, the one that I took, one of many, Astronomy and Design. Whoops. We didn't want that yet. Okay. There's two Astronomy and Design courses, an 8-week and a 5-week. How many of you have had the 8-week? The Astronomy and Design course? A few years ago. All right, and then there's the 5-week one, which they give once a year also. Okay, this is the actual title of what we're going to talk about today. What are exoplanet discoveries telling us about life and intelligence in the universe? And why Christian apologists should take an interest in what scientists are telling us about the discovery of planets around our star and the galaxy. Now, this talk I kind of developed with Otis Graf, one of the teachers for Reason. So he's in the Houston chapter. So anytime you have a question, just raise your hand. It's recording.
I know, but I have my own.
Sure, go ahead. By the way, you can go to paradoxes.org and hear the recording. And generally, we put the video on, too, right? I mean, the slideshow. Am I right, Mark? Are we still doing that? Trying to? Trying to. Yeah, Richard's not here now, so it's a little more difficult. But. Okay. Popular opinions about life in the universe. Environment with liquid water are almost sure to have life, which is what most astrobiologists would say. The term astrobiologist is on your list. Microbial life is abundant. Complex life is rare in the universe. That's the rare earth hypothesis, that more conservative book I showed you. There's an abundance of technological civilizations in the galaxies, almost all of which are much more advanced than ours. SETI Institute. What's SETI?
Search for
Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute. So there's SETI and then there's Institute. So. And we'll get into that a little more later. It would be extreme arrogance to think that we are the only intelligent beings and that our planet uniquely hosts life. That's Carl Sagan and many others, part of what we call the mediocrity principle, that life and intelligent life found throughout the universe. So, all right, some opinions of prominent researchers. Here's one by Jeffrey Marcy. You cannot doubt that there is intelligent life in the universe everywhere. But the real question is, how common is intelligent life? You know, kind of answered it. I do have a video to watch. I want you to listen to him for a few minutes. And we'll try to use the hotspot and get it. If not, Mark helped me download the copy of it. So we'll go to that. Let's look at the rest of the things on this. The study of planets and moons in our solar system leads us to believe that life would be an easy start on another world. That's Chris McKay, an astrobiologist. I would not be very surprised if the solar system contains the only life in the observable universe. I arrive at this dismal conclusion because I see so many contingent features in the origin and evolution of life. Paul Davies. Now, he's a little more conservative about it. And he was a well-known physicist, I think Arizona State. And he died a couple years ago. But we use his text in the Astronomy and Design course. Oops. Intelligent life might develop into something we would not like to meet. That was Stephen Hawking. Typical Hawking statement.
Well, he said there might be Klingons
out there. Yeah. Let me see if I got the video for you. Yeah, here it is. It's about a 5-minute video. There's another one coming up later, so just you'll get to hear what one of the well-known astrobiologists. It's the typical thinking of some of these scientists.
System, its projection was much bigger than.
It's not this guy. It's the next guy.
That's the kind of thing Kepler's looking for. We don't resolve
this. Oops! It didn't come on. Okay. I got to close the other one down. I took Windows 10 off of here, but and that helped. Yeah, and I'm trying to get the audio on for the. Okay, that's one way to do it.
And if a planet goes in front of it, we can see it dim for a little while and hopefully determine based on that that we're actually seeing a planet.
Not sure what's going on.
And I think I'll pass on to Jeff to talk about some of the results. I guess the one thing is Kepler's been operating in space for about 3 years now, and we just recently got a mission extension from NASA to operate another 4 years. So hopefully we'll be taking data successfully for about 7 years total, 7 or 8 years.
That's right. I'm Jeff Marcy, and I'm really delighted to be here, and I'm amazed to see so many people here interested in SETI and also the planets being discovered by the Kepler Space Telescope, that the planets are offering us some remarkable news about the prospects of the abodes for life elsewhere in the universe. And I thought I would focus my attention on what Kepler is telling us about habitable planets that we didn't know beforehand, and information that bears directly on the search for life in the universe as well as intelligent life. And it's very hard to know where to begin because Kepler has found nearly 3,000 planets so far. We haven't verified all of them, but most of them are real planets. And among those 3,000 planets, we find some that are the size of Jupiter. Some of them are orbiting close into the planet, to the star. Some are orbiting far. we find planets the size of Saturn, of Neptune, and then quite amazingly, hundreds and hundreds of planets are being found by Kepler, as Doug described, that are the size nearly that of the Earth. Some of them are 1.5 times the size of the Earth, some of them twice the size of the Earth. Some of them are smaller than the Earth. We have something like 50 or so planets smaller than the Earth. And so we're beginning to discover with Kepler the full range, the diversity of planet sizes and also orbital distances from the host star. And of course, orbital distance determines the temperature of the planet, especially when you fold in the greenhouse effect. With all of that diversity and all of these planets, I wanted to give you a message in just a minute or two here, what I think is most relevant to SETI. And I thought very hard about this, because most of you know already that Kepler is designed, as Doug mentioned, to find Earth-like planets. Frankly, we don't even know what an Earth-like planet is. What are the properties of our own planet Earth that render it Earth-like? Is it the composition of the atmosphere, of the oceans, the plate tectonics? Is it the core, the mantle, the presence of the moon, Jupiter not too far away, and so on? We don't know what an Earth-like planet is if it slapped us in the face. But with that holy grail, finding other Earths or nearly Earth-like planets in mind, there's a discovery that Kepler is making right now that I think is as profound or maybe more so than the discovery of an Earth clone. And that discovery is this. Kepler has now found several hundred planets. In fact, the vast majority of the planets have sizes between that of the Earth and 2 or 3 times that of the Earth. 1 to 3 Earth diameters as we measure them from the amount of dimming of the star as the planet crosses in front. The bigger the planet, the more the star dims when the planet crosses in front. So we measure the sizes of the planets quite incontrovertibly. And amazingly, and we didn't expect this before the mission was launched, amazingly, the vast majority, 2/3, 3/4 of the planets, are between the size of the Earth and 2 or 3 times the size of the Earth. What are these planets that are frankly smaller than Uranus and Neptune, but a little bit bigger than the Earth? Well, we have some very good clues of what they are. We have been able to measure the density of about 15 or so of these planets that are nearly the size of the Earth. And their densities come out to be nearly 1 gram per cubic centimeter. And you might be saying, I remember from high school chemistry, I'm supposed to know what 1 gram per cubic centimeter means. I'll remind you if you've forgotten. That's the density of water. Water has a density of 1 gram per cc. And when you find planets with a density of 1, you know for sure that they're not pure rock, like the Earth. You also know that they're not made of pure gas. They're too small. They'd be too fluffy if made of gas. The density would be lower than 1. These are planets that almost certainly, and we have some ancillary evidence to point in this direction, these are planets that have a large component of water. They might be 30% water, 50% water, 70% water, the rest being maybe rock and maybe some gases. But predominantly they are indeed composed almost certainly of water. And I'm leaving out other details of other planets that have been studied carefully, both discovered by Kepler and maybe by other teams, where we actually have detections of the water spectroscopically. So what this means for SETI is this. When you look up into the night sky at the thousands of stars your naked eye can see, and of course you know that that's a small fraction of the hundreds of billions of stars that inhabit our Milky Way galaxy, what you know when you think about the stars at night is that a vast majority of those stars have these remarkable planets. They're something like the size of the Earth, a little bigger than the Earth, some of them may be smaller, but there must be large amounts of water. And we all know what's special about water with regard to SETI. Water is the key solvent of biochemical reactions. It's the cocktail mixer that allows the carbon-based molecules to break apart, reassemble into other forms, amino acids, maybe eventually proteins, and perhaps, if you break them apart and reassemble them enough, into something like DNA. And so it's the liquid water on these hordes of planets that offer, I think, a real hope that there are planets out there with which have developed replicating molecules like DNA, maybe not exactly DNA, some other replicating molecule. Those replicating molecules will compete for resources, for the energy, for the other atoms, and eventually that competition will lead to surviving molecules that outcompete the others, and voila, you have Darwinian evolution. The successful molecules will move on, presumably develop a lipid-based shell that we would call a cell membrane, and voila, you have the first signs of life. And so I think what Kepler has discovered is widely appreciated. It's these very likely water worlds as a predominant type of planet in the universe, water worlds that can certainly serve as the petri dishes for life as we know it.
Before we go to Seth, let me just encourage people, if you have a seat next to you, would you raise your hand? You have an empty seat. So people in the back, if you're just scouting out whether we're interesting, you can stay back. But if you actually want to sit down, there are seats available wherever you see a raised hand. Come on up and join the group. And I'm going to turn things over now to Seth Shasta.
Thank you, Andy. I have to say I feel humbled sitting here on this panel, although as somebody pointed out in the audience, Seth, you should feel humble. But
I want to get rid of it. And I'll reopen. There it is. Close that. I think I'm okay on that. Is it on there? Yeah, okay. All right. Okay. Voila.
Would you remind us who that speaker was?
Pardon me?
Would you remind us who that speaker was?
Jeffrey, 1 second. Jeff Marcy, yeah.
Mark, you want the light?
Yeah, one light, please. So, was that profound or?
No.
Remember, he is a PhD astrobiologist, and I think at one of the UCs, and there's a lot of people out there with that same mental attitude. So,
Mark, has anybody publicly declared that astrobiology is a factory science?
I don't think anybody has a nerve right now for some. Maybe.
Usually, a science that has a name to it has data for it. But the word for biological targets. Yeah, where's the meat? Where's the beef?
Well, I'll show you a little bit. It's sort of pablum, but that's all we got so far. And there's going to be a lot of money put into it to study it. Yeah, a lot of tax dollars. And with some ground, you know, we are literally finding exoplanets. We found
every week.
Kepler's got well over 1,000 that are verified, and then candidates another 2,000 to 3,000. So it's growing, but the Kepler's reaching its terminal stage, and in the next 2 years. 17 and 18, they're going to put up two more satellite telescopes, James Webb and one called TESS. And they're going to be much bigger than Kepler's. But they're still very limited on what you can see, even with those. You cannot literally tell if there's life on any planet, no matter how many of those you find. We don't have a telescope big enough to tell if there's life there. Oh, yeah, it's going to cost trillions.
It's got to come. I mean, it's science. It's forward.
Yes, sir.
I can understand the distance, and you can see the star dim, but how do they tell you, I mean, can you get an accurate diameter of the object passing in front of that star? size of the star is passing in front of it. How do you know the density? How do they determine that? They get so excited about water.
Good question. Yeah, they can tell the density of the planet. Well, first of all, they watch for the planet to transit, to go right in front of the star, and the star's light will dim maybe far less than 1%. So that's how they know there's a planet there. And then to get to the density, they actually watch for wobble. Like when the star gets over to the side, the planet gets to the side of that star, it actually moves the star slightly according to its mass. So that's how they can do it. But most of the ones that Kepler's found, they can't do that yet. They're too far away, and
that seems to be some very precise measurements at those distances. I'm just astounded.
It is astounding that they can do it. It's very much so. Yes, sir.
Basically, like you say, they can tell the size of the planet by the amount that the light is dim.
Yes.
They give them the diameter of the planet. They can tell the mass of the planet. They then measure the frequency, how rapidly the planet goes around the star.
Mm-hmm.
So they have that velocity, and they also have the distance between the orbit of the planet going around it and the center of the star. So with those measurements, then they can the velocity going around, the distance between the orbit of the planet and the star, that gives them the total mass, and knowing the size. Mass over volume gives you the density.
Thanks. Is it Greg?
It's Greg,
right?
That calculation is very simple.
Very good. So there's ways to do it, but I can tell you on most of them they can't see them well enough to even do that yet. They can get that transit, but remember, here's the thing about transits: they have to line up perfectly with the Earth. That star and its planet going in front of it. If the planet's going this way, or you know, like that, you're not going to get a transit. So you'll never know it's there.
It has to be on the plane of observation.
The same plane, the ecliptic. Yes.
Has anyone ever caught these scientists lying or exaggerating to any degree?
What did I just show?
I was cutting the birthday card.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
What degree do you think we have to tweak our theology and our apologetics? In other words, some people think that we have to tweak our theology greatly. Some people think that our apologetics, like the fine-tuning argument, either has to be tweaked or thrown away. In your opinion, what degree, if at all, do you think we have to
All right. Can you allow me to hold that thought? Because we're going to get to a couple slides on that.
Right.
Great question. And we'll kind of lead into it smoothly. Let's see if I can get this working again here. Okay. Let me catch up here. Okay, we watched that video from Jeff Marcy, and we read these already, so we're on. Okay, and of course it stimulated lots of movies from the 50s. That's when the movie started. Anybody remember this one? It's true, you know. War of the Worlds, that was a great one from the 50s. And they remade it, right? War of the Worlds, about 10 years ago. Tom Cruise. Alien, early 70s. And then other things like X-Files and Star Trek and Star Wars and on, you know. There's probably 1,000 of these movies out there now.
Space Patrol.
Space Patrol. That was a TV series back in the 50s, if I remember
right.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Some opinions of the guys we just... here's another researcher, Ellen Stofan. She's NASA chief scientist. And her comments were, I think we're going to have strong indications of life beyond Earth within a decade. I think we're going to have definite evidence within 20 to 30 years. We know where to look, we know how to look. In most cases, we have the technology. We're on the path to implementing it. And so I think we're definitely on the road. That was just a year ago. So, okay, so again, that same attitude, okay? Can we find life?
Yeah,
God can make life. The big question is, will he make intelligent life in beyond the earth? That's the bigger question. Hi, Steve. Yes.
Yeah, thanks. And this has been a question for me that's just, on the back burner. But a couple of things. There's a favorite word of Hugh's. It's polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
Yeah.
That are the same things that come off our grill at the 4th of July barbecue. Well,
yes.
That comes from life. And when I remember 15 years ago, somebody in the spectroscopy of starlight discovered this vinegar, which they called acetic acid, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's an organic life-produced molecule. And I've not heard the result of that or tried to follow up on it, but I keep getting these organic molecules that come naturally in deep space. And it's just a question that keeps bugging.
Mm-hmm. They are finding more somewhat simple, getting more complex with time, organic chemicals in space like acetic acid, vinegar, anybody remember what vinegar is or what acetic acid is? It's a small molecule. And so, I don't know what the follow-up is on that either.
And that discovery is using spectroscopy is a pretty good science.
Yes.
That helps us get information that would be hard
right.
to get a great distance.
What Steve's talking about is you can take the light coming from a source like another planet and run it through a spectrometer and you can tell what kind of molecules are coming through that light or near that light. And so that's just a scientific method of testing. And, yeah, they're finding more.
He was addressed that in the class. And there are There are natural processes for creating light. You don't have to have light.
Yes.
He was addressed that in the class.
When you do, when you're in certain types of radiation or ultraviolet, some chemicals can be produced, some organic chemicals. And, yes. Let's say you're on the moon and you have a spectrometer. You can look at Earth's light and you can tell if there's hydrogen in our atmosphere. Because hydrogen will block certain wavelengths of light. And on your spectrometer, which has all the wavelengths, you'll see a blank spot there. So you know hydrogen's present. And molecules like acetic acid has a certain wavelength, or maybe more than one wavelength, it blocks. And that's how you can tell. Now, right now, the spectrometers are not accurate enough, and you need bigger telescopes to get more light before you can start applying spectral analysis to lights from exoplanets. It's just we're not there. And maybe in 50 years, Al?
Why are we so intent on finding intelligent life? We haven't got one on this.
Hey.
Another thing is that, and I'm not sure on this, I read somewhere that because of our position on the galaxy, we can only see, what is it, John, do you know, about 10% or so we can't see all the stars, in other words, we can only see a small fraction of the stars in the sky. Until we get better.
Yeah.
A better position where we can see the rest of the cosmos, then that number.
To get out of the plane of the galaxy.
Yeah,
you're going to need to be able to fly a few hundred million light years, and the technology is nowhere near that. Yes. Yeah, that's one of the reasons we're talking about it. Yes, very good. Okay, here's another really good video, if I can get it working. So let's watch it. It's a little bit longer, but Jamie, I may need you to come in. Where's Jamie? Oh, he left.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. He drug it over.
Yeah, you have to
bring the whole thing over.
Is there life elsewhere in the universe? Anyone who has pondered the immensity of the cosmos has probably wondered at some time or another whether life exists beyond our planet.
One of the most interesting and exciting questions that people have been asking for millennia is, are we alone? You know, even as a child, I stared up at the night sky, saw all those stars, and couldn't imagine that some of them didn't have planets with people on them who were looking back at me, wondering the same thing. We are now at the point where we can scientifically answer that question.
The search for life beyond Earth has been buoyed by recent discoveries made by NASA's Kepler telescope. It's looking for planets outside our solar system, known as exoplanets. Kepler measures the brightness of distant stars and tracks a star's dimming when a planet passes in front. Up until 1995, exoplanets were purely theoretical, but scientists have since identified thousands of them.
You know, just 20 years ago, we didn't know of any planets beyond our solar system. And now here we are, we know that there's pretty much a planet for every star, and then we know about one out of every five of those planets could harbor life. That's such a profound difference in one generation's worth of work in our understanding of the cosmos. It blows me away every time I think about it. And it blows me away every time I go out at night, because I can count, I can literally go and not just count stars, I can now count planets.
But one thing that has been very important, and is one of the real growth points of astronomy at the moment, is the realization that most stars are orbited by retinues of planets, just as the Sun is orbited by the Earth and the other familiar planets, and that many of those planets are rather like the young Earth. There are probably within our Milky Way galaxy billions of planets rather like the Earth. And of course, many people would guess that there is life on them, but we can't be so sure about that, nor what life is like.
In July, NASA scientists announced the discovery of one of their most exciting exoplanets yet, Kepler-452b. Located some 14,000 light-years away, the planet is in the habitable zone, which means it's the right distance from its own sun, and also the right size, to potentially be Earth-like.
So Kepler-452b is one of the most habitable planets, or one of the most potentially habitable planets that we've ever found. Of the things that we're able to measure about this planet, there's a lot of it that seems much like what we experience here on our own home planet. And that's what's got a lot of the scientific community so excited.
There is a limit to how much we can learn about Kepler-452b because of its distance. NASA is launching the James Webb Telescope in 2018 to find Earth-like planets closer to home, so they can study their atmospheres for biosignatures that would indicate the presence of life. But there's another way to learn more about distant planets beyond what the Kepler telescope can tell us, and that is to look for signs of intelligent life. Frank Drake has been listening out for signals of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe for over 50 years. Mr. Drake came up with something called the Drake Equation, which is a mathematical formula that estimates how many advanced civilizations capable of transmitting signals might exist in the universe. He co-founded the SETI Institute, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Scientists at the SETI Institute have been searching for intelligent life for the past few decades.
How does SETI search? Well, we look at our own technology and determine which one of our technologies is detectable across the distances which separate the stars. What we can detect is our radio signals, our television broadcasts, of which, of course, there are thousands, our radar transmissions, which are even easier to detect. And so we search for those. And so just recently, to the radio search, we have added a light search.
SETI researchers have not come across any signals yet, but they say this is to be expected.
So in our galaxy, a couple hundred billion stars, we've looked carefully at maybe a couple of thousand stars. Right? That means we've looked at 1/1,000,000th of the star systems in our galaxy carefully. 1/1,000,000. So, you know, that's like going into the ocean, taking a glass of water and saying, you see any sharks in there, Bob? Well, I don't. Well, I guess there are no sharks in the ocean. Well, that'd be a little premature, right? All it means is your sample size isn't big enough. And that would be very discouraging if it weren't for the fact that the technology keeps getting faster. So there's hope.
SETI's efforts recently got a huge boost with the launch of Breakthrough Listen, overseen by Martin Rees, Stephen Hawking, and Frank Drake, and funded by Silicon Valley entrepreneur Uri Milner. The project will greatly expand the organization's capacity to search and sift through data. But scientists aren't only interested in discovering life forms light years away.
Of course, the only places we can directly look for life apart from Earth are on the planets and moons of our solar system. And there has been talk about, could there be some kind of life on Mars? Could there be something on comets? Could there be something under the frozen ice on Europa, one of Jupiter's moons, or Enceladus, one of Saturn's moons? And it's possible that people find life. No one expects any very complex life in those places, but even evidence of simple life would be important.
At first glance, our solar system seems like a rather unlikely place to find life beyond Earth. But the reason scientists think it is plausible is because of the discovery of a group of organisms called extremophiles that live on Earth.
So extremophiles are a group of organisms that we've discovered that live in what we consider extreme environments. And so we have found organisms that live at temperatures that exceed boiling water, at pHs the same, lower than battery acid.
Scientists are looking at the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, as well as our nearest neighbor, Mars.
And so what we're looking for is something that might, with a microscope, might look like life. Life needs water, so we've been very interested in water worlds. So what the Curiosity rover is doing now is going around Gale Crater and investigating ancient riverbeds and features that indicate, and chemistry that indicate, that there was water present.
You know, you look at Jupiter, it's a big gas ball, you figure there'd probably no life there, and that's probably true. But Jupiter has, I don't think, like close to 70 moons that we know about. And several of them are very large, you know, the size of our own moon, maybe even a little bit bigger. At least three of them are thought to have underneath their surfaces, and the surface might just be ice or rock, but underneath, maybe 10 miles down, maybe 100 miles down, they might have liquid oceans, hidden, dark, inky dark oceans down there with liquid water that's been sitting there for 4 billion years. So after that length of time, there might be something that's cooked up in there.
The hope is that if we find further life in our solar system, on places like Mars, we will improve our understanding of how easily it might have started elsewhere. But there is another way to answer this question, determining how it started on Earth.
So until we understand how life began, we don't know how likely it is or how unique the pathway was that led to life on Earth.
One man who is trying to come up with an answer to this question is Jack Szostak. In his lab at Harvard University, he's trying to determine how easy it is to create life by making it himself.
So we work on the origin of life. We are trying to do simple experiments in the lab that will give us some clues as to how life got started on the early Earth. Our approach is to work with the chemicals that we think were involved and try to see how they could assemble into a simple kind of cell.
Modern cells are intricate nanoscale factories stuffed with thousands of different chemicals, each taking part in a complicated and messy web of reactions. Long strands of DNA encode a cell's genetic information. Shorter strands of RNA carry that information around the cell, telling it how to manufacture the proteins that run the chemical reactions it requires to live. It seems unlikely that these systems all evolved at the same time. At the Szostak lab, they're focused on two experiments, one to work out how primitive cell membranes could grow and divide into daughter cells, and the other on RNA replication.
So we hope to be able to recreate the conditions in lab that allowed life to come about in the first place on the early Earth. And a big part of that is learning how to make RNA that can undergo spontaneous self-replication without the need for modern-day enzymes.
Dr. Szostak and his team have already created a protocell from a blob of lipids which contains RNA. The sticking point at the moment is working out how to make RNA that can copy itself without relying on a helping hand from RNA enzymes.
The ultimate goal of this is to create from chemicals, a simple living system where we can see Darwinian evolution operating, the emergence of new functions. So in a sense, it would be a reconstitution of the beginnings of biology in a lab setting. One of the things we hope to learn from that, of course, is how life might have started on the early Earth.
If it is a difficult process, reliant upon various bits of luck or circumstance, then it is possible that we are a cosmic fluke, one that isn't going to be repeated elsewhere. But if experiments like Dr. Shostak's show that life emerges easily, then the odds of life appearing elsewhere in the universe look more likely. Perhaps one day, when we're looking into the night sky, we'll finally know the answer to the question, are we alone?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, just a couple of the topics that you opened doors to was obviously the first one was exoplanets and life in habitable zones, and then SETI, which is you know, as you saw, antennas pointing out of space, trying to listen for intelligent life, and now.
What is the universe made of? Scientists have determined that normal matter, the stuff that makes up the Earth, the stars, and everything we can see, only makes up a small portion of the universe. The rest is made up of two mysterious components that are shaping our universe in profound ways. Much of the mass of the universe is made up of something called dark matter, which neither reflects nor emits light, but, like the matter we can see, pulls things together with gravity. And space itself seems to be permeated by an unusual force called dark energy.
There you go. Okay. Go ahead, Dave. Yeah, Dave's talking.
Speaking of intelligence, obviously, it's sitting here is very difficult because you're insulting my intelligence to know these people. What's very interesting is people that get all excited about exoplanets, and even some people have reasons to believe have gotten all excited about these exoplanets. And they spent a lot of time talking about the characteristics of these exoplanets. I have people that know that I obviously believe, the universe was designed for life and the design parameters. It's interesting when this exciting exoplanet was discovered, the one that was very similar, quote unquote, to Earth. You know, I was emailed, it was put on my Facebook page over and over again. And I was able to shut down all those critics because what you don't look at in these things that are discussions is that the planet is obviously irrelevant to life if the star is not correct. And in this discussion, you notice not a single one of them talked about the design characteristics of the star. So every single one of these exoplanets that these people get all excited about and the ones that come to me there, I then look up the information. There's a big database on every star.
There is.
Millions and millions of stars. You can go online. There's a database for all of them.
Yeah.
And we have not found one solar twin, which means that every single time they find one of these exoplanets, the star that it's orbiting is totally unstable. You sit there and say, well, I had liquid water. Well, maybe it did for maybe what? You know, a minute, a month, 2 months, but it didn't have it for even a year. None of these planets, these stars, are stable enough even to have liquid water for 1 year because their brightness is changing 1%, 2%, 3%. So these planets will freeze, then they're going to totally boil. They're going to freeze and boil. And our sun is the most stable burning object, in the universe.
It is.
We have not found. So once you find a star that's as stable as our sun, then tell me about the exoplanet. But until then, I don't care if you find, a billion exoplanets. If you can't find a star that will support life and not boil the life away 1 month and freeze it the next month, you have absolutely nothing. The second one, obviously, the SETI stuff is totally, totally obviously insulting my intelligent electronic engineer. Is if those antennas, in order to pick up a signal, you would have to be able to turn the star on and off. Those are the same antennas that we use for radio astronomy, where we listen to the output of stars.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're able to take a star and turn it on and off, maybe we can get some Morse code from outer space. But in the meantime, you're not going to hear anything. And then this guy to tell us that our radio waves and our X-rays are going out into the universe and somebody else could listen to it. I got news, I mean, you people obviously live here. You barely obviously can get, high def TV over digital waves here, it just barely makes 20 miles from the mountaintop of your house. It doesn't make it past the moon. It doesn't make it out of our solar system. In order to listen to Voyager, which has left our solar system, we have to have, a big, huge antenna in Goldstone exactly pointed at that spacecraft that has an antenna that's about one-fourth the size of this room, and they have to be perfectly aligned, and then we get just right now at dial modem speed. Dial modem speed. If you're enough, I mean, not old enough to know that.
you know, to send a picture would take 3-4 hours, you know. And so these antennas that are pointing out are space. It's insulting to my intelligence. I'm sorry.
It's a waste of money.
It's a waste of money and insulting to my intelligence. Unless you're looking for a star to go on and off, you know.
Okay, hang on a minute now. Let me get through a few slides, okay?
Yeah.
Or we're never going to get anywhere here. Okay, some of the speakers you saw were Frank Drake, Sostak. He's the guy in the lab that's going to make life. You hear Fuzz Rana, you know, the reasons to believe scholars say that he may someday. And with the degree of complexity and resources that have to go into trying to put a cell together, it could happen. And it just argues against it happening naturally.
Maybe we should worship him if he comes up with that.
Yeah, he's God, I guess.
I wouldn't worship him.
No, we're joking, Steve. Martin Rees, he's the guy that throws out the anthropic selection, that there's a selection bias, that we're the reason we think we see design in the universe is because we're here to see design in the universe. It's just pure chance that we're able to see it, because if we weren't here, nothing would be here to see it. That old story about the bear in the woods and all, you know. Okay.
Nobody thought America was there.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, and Sostak.
That's the same analogy.
Okay, I'll call on you when I got time here, okay? We're running out of time, so. Okay, notable quotes. Are we alone? We can now scientifically answer that question. We heard that.
Sure.
There's pretty much a planet for every star. That's probably true, just about. Problem is, most of the stars are double stars. So you're going to have that planet is going to be torn and tossed about in its orbit. And most of the stars are small little, what we call M-class stars. They're tiny little red dwarfs.
And none of them are stable.
Yeah, and they're not stable. And the star, well, we'll get into that in a minute. In our galaxy, there are billions of planets rather like Earth. Woo! Now that's quite a statement. We also heard Kepler 452 is the most exciting find yet, one of the most potentially habitable planets that we have ever found. It is much like what is experienced on our home planet. Well, we'll get into that more. Not really. SETI has recently received a large increase in funding. They have. Remember, it's private funding. So it's not. It used to be federal funding. They were looking for simple life in the solar system. Extremophiles that are found on Earth indicate that other life is possible. Okay, you know what an extremophile is? Those are those little bacteria and things that live in, like, boiling water at Yellowstone and acid water, thermal vents in the ocean where it's like 200 degrees Fahrenheit. But you know, we looked at them genetically, and they're genetic. Their genome is big. It's like twice as big as a normal bacterium. So, you know, just for a bacterium, which we now know is extremely complex, not a simple organism at all, to have evolved is infinitesimally almost impossible. Let's see, since there's water, there might be something that just cooked up in there. We heard that too. Meaning molecules. You heard one of the persons say that molecules and atoms themselves undergo Darwinian selection. The molecules, which have absolutely no, you cannot call them living, compete with each other to come together and make molecules that compete with each other to come together and make life. So that's kind of a new concept, that molecules are also undergoing Darwinian selection. Yes, question? Uh-oh. I'll give you 30 seconds and a 30-second answer.
Okay, 30 seconds. When we're talking about these kinds of things, these really, really small, infinitesimally very small organisms, is it possible at all to somehow have the discourse be similar between the discussion of what constitutes life on other planets and abortion topics? Because a lot of people have discussions about what's considered life in the early stages of humans. Very, very similar to these other very, very small, and they're still
Not quite sure what your question is, but are you trying to compare life on Earth with what it might be in another place? Is that what? Okay, yeah. Well, you know, there a lot of these astrobiologists are coming up with a lot of different theories and hypotheses. And you've probably all heard, instead of using carbon as the base for life, try to use nitrogen. And nitrogen, which is, you know, it's near carbon in the periodic table. And it's got an outer electron shell that's similar to carbon. And so it can combine with three or four atoms, just like carbon can. But it's very unstable on Earth. When you have molecules of nitrogen, it's unstable and breaks apart. Except for maybe nitrogen, the nitrogen that's in the atmosphere in two. But the thought is, if you go to a place like Titan, the moon Titan, where it's so cold, there's liquid methane, which is a gas, you know, on Earth. Well, it's liquefied there, and they think that the nitrogen could actually come together and form spheres, like the membranes on a bacterium. So it would be made out of nitrogen compounds instead of it would have a very long, slow metabolic process, maybe thousands or millions of years. So this is how, you can hypothesize and go really far out with things like that. But if it's carbon-based, it's going to be, you know, they've looked at it in so many different ways to try to figure out how you could do it much differently than we have on Earth. They're not succeeding. Yeah, Jim?
I think she was asking about the definition of life when people talk about aborting a human fetus. They say,
I thought I heard you life. Say that, yeah.
This is not life, but yet this little smaller thing than that, and less more primitive than that, on this far away life, that's life. And it's kind of a contradiction.
Yeah, that's true.
I see.
You're right.
Good point. Okay, yes.
A fundamental question, I think, in looking for life, I think that science actually accepts in looking for life other places, is that life can develop from a non-biological chemicals into a biological system. That's an assumption that they make. Now, the fundamental step in proving that is that they show that it occurs here. And that's a step that they have not yet done. They have not yet shown how life develops out of non-life issues, non-life material. So that's an important aspect of assuming that life can exist elsewhere. I mean, here on Earth, if we've identified what they claim to be life down to very simple organisms, you know, like maybe
virus.
700 molecules in size. Mm-hmm. They think, like Hughes told us, that those were observed like 3.8 billion years ago. Mm-hmm. And science has not yet shown, even if we accept that as an indication of life, science has not yet shown how it started.
That's right.
We have the chemicals, but what imbued those chemicals is what we call life.
Right. And you heard on...
That's a fundamental issue.
It is. And you heard on here that some of these people are accepting the idea that the molecules themselves are competing with each other. And then that somehow produces life. So, it's getting pretty far out. But let me move along here. Finding another planet. Five most Earth-like planets so far. And you see Earth over on the right side there. And Kepler-22 on B on the left. Kepler, the 22 means it's the 22nd star discovered by Kepler. B is the second planet that they found on Kepler, 22. So the most important one you heard about in the film was Kepler 452b. I think they mentioned Kepler 186. And another, Gliese 581. These are just some of the big when they were found, they said these are Earth's twin, but since then they kind of backed off on it. Kepler 186b, Kepler 452. Here's a little bit of information on Gliese 581. It was published in July 12 in Scientific American. And some of the comments in there, my own personal feeling is that the chances of life on this planet are 100%. I have almost no doubt about it. That was Stephen Vogt. Let's see, properties of Gliese. Here's some of the things you need to know. It's more than twice as massive as Earth. That would transfer into it. The gravity on that would be probably about 1.2, 1.3 times our gravity. Its host is an M dwarf star. That's those little red stars. And you get a lot of solar flaring out of those. Yet the planet has to be very close because it's such a cold little star. So that star, that planet's going to get bathed in that that radiation. Orbital period's only 30 days. Tidally locked. That means the planet, one side is always facing the star. One side's always hot. One side's always freezing cold. You do have that little edge, you know, where the two come together. Likely no atmosphere.
How can they verify it's tidally locked?
I don't know. That's a good one, yeah.
You
got to see it.
That just goes with closeness. If you're too close to a massive object, it becomes locked. That's just the law of physics. So it's why our moon is locked, because our moon is so close. So if an object gets too close, the gravity is just going to lock it. You don't have to measure that. That just goes with the distance.
I guess there's a mathematical formula.
It's not to be unlocked.
Right. Well, it rotates once per orbit.
Rotation.
Yeah. It's like our moon. Our moon is tidally locked.
Or
Mercury. You know, our moon, you never see the back of our moon, right? It does do this a little bit, so we see probably we see more than half the moon, but not much. Okay, and then another one, Kepler 186f. This is the best case of habitable planet found yet. And I'm just reading a quote there. And there's a picture of it, a little bit bigger than Earth. It's also an M dwarf star. And
you should know, obviously, the picture is a artist's rendition. We don't have pictures. We don't have pictures of
it. Right. Orbit 130 days. Orbit is probably tidally locked. Habitability depends on atmosphere. Very active star likely stripped the atmosphere away. Again, those small M class stars. The planet has to be too close to it. Yeah, John.
I don't know if you could answer this, but why in the world don't these people talk about, these experts? There are actually 8 habitable zones, as Hugh has pointed out. They're only talking about 1 of the 8. You need all 8 to make life possible. It doesn't guarantee life, but to get a planet capable of supporting life, you need a planet that fits all 8 habitable zones.
Right.
And so far, we have not found one single planet that fits all 8 habitable zones. And then after you get through those gates, you have like something like 200 or 300 finely tuned things on top of that.
Exactly.
That have to be just right on a planet to make it capable of supporting life. And they don't address any of those.
No.
So why do these people, it's like it's biased to the extreme.
John, they just won't look at all that stuff. And
if you weren't overly optimistic, then you would be depressed. It's like Hugh and Buzz went to the Orange of Life conference where they're really honest about they have absolutely no answers. And Hugh said, you know, there was, you know, 3,000 people in the room and they're all 100% depressed. I mean, how could you go to work every day and try and do this stuff if you know the truth, obviously, is that your work is totally hopeless?
You know?
So these people obviously have to be overly optimistic. Otherwise, you wouldn't wake up in the morning and go to work, I guess.
Okay, listen, I only got about 5 minutes left, so either I'm going to finish this another time, or what do you suggest, Mark?
How much time do you need?
Oh, probably a half hour at this, the rate we're going.
Well, you want to hold it over to another date? I've got another date.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll keep going then. I'll take the questions.
No, excuse me. This time there are no more questions or comments. You must wrap up.
Well, I'm not going to wrap up, I don't think.
No, this is the end of class, so you have to give a brief summary.
Okay. All right, let's...
Let, group with somebody of your opinion. You've heard everybody else's opinion. I've heard these two opinions. I want to hear your opinion.
Well, I wanted to get to the a couple other things here. All right.
No question. Put your hand down.
All right, no more questions. Okay, Kepler, there's some information on Kepler. It's a G star, like our star. So this one does have a yellow star, five times more massive than Earth, the planet is. It means the gravity is at least two times greater. You wouldn't be able to walk on it. But some forms of life, who knows? You know, the bacteria could probably withstand it. It probably has a runaway greenhouse. Okay, here we go. This is a lot of you have been talking about the what's called the habitable zone. When they say habitable zone, they're only talking about the water habitable zone. And John just mentioned there's eight. Actually, there's nine now. And it's growing. And so up here you see this is an M-class star here. It's a little star, and you saw, we mentioned Kepler-186. It orbits within this green zone, which we call the water habitable zone, or habitable zone. And that, you can see how close it has to be to its star. That's why it gets bathed in radiation. And then here's Kepler-452. Here's B. And this is the yellow star that it has. And it orbits within this water habitable zone. Water won't evaporate away, and water won't freeze.
Just to find, that means there could be water for a moment of time, but it's not continuous water. Be
exactly.
Clear. You're not talking about continuous water.
Same with ours. There's a here's Earth habitable, excuse me, our solar system habitable zone, and you can see we have Mars is just out on the outer edge, almost to the frozen area. Earth and Venus is on the inner edge, and it's actually within inside of it. So Venus has basically no water left on it, and so. So the assumption is if you have a habitable zone and there's a planet orbiting, life can occur there. So here's another way to look at it. And let's see. On the x-axis, you can see that this is a distance in astronomical units. That's one being the distance to the Earth. And you see Earth up here, right there, I think. And this blue zone is actually the they drew it blue on this particular drawing instead of green. And here's our sun at one. This is one solar mass here. And if you pass over here to the right on the x-axis, you find Earth. You go down to the distance from it. You find one astronomical unit is Earth's distance. So you pick something like a class M red star, and you can see how the habitable zone is much closer here. And so any planets in this zone would get irradiated. Here's a K level. These two are K, and this would be a G level star. That's what's called the main sequence stars. We put them in a classification of size called the main sequence. No, no questions.
So what do you think?
Okay. So actually, I have another whole set of a part two for this anyway. So we're about out of time, but I think, you know, to me, it's pretty clear that we have a lot of top-notch scientists in this country and around the world that are not using real science to come to the conclusion that their life can originate in any of these types of habitable zones. And it's ubiquitous. It should be throughout our galaxy and the universe. And they accept it more on a a faith basis. It's not really science, and they've like disregarded the scientific method. You know, there's nothing wrong with going out and searching and looking and finding, just exploring, and that's fine. I'm all for the satellites that we put up to look for these things, but to jump to the conclusions they do is pretty hard.
We could look at Genesis 1 and see what the difference is. God just goes like this and does it. That's no problem. To do it intelligently.
Okay, Al. Thank you, Al. All right, so anyway, we'll stop there, and we can pick it up at another time. Yeah. Lord God, thank you for this time and for our Independence Day. We celebrate tomorrow all the freedoms you give us, Lord. Lord, we bring all these top-notch scientists in the world before you. We know most of them are agnostics or atheists or deists, whatever they may be, Lord, we ask you to help them, Lord. Prick their consciences and their spirits and help them to at least understand what the scientific method is and what your word teaches us, Lord, on using the scientific method. Bring them out of their darkness. In Jesus' name, amen.